wise man, in the first part of the verse, assumes the character of a gay and thoughtless libertine, and in the true spirit of a libertine, counsels the youth whom he is addressing to give himself up to an unrestrained course of amusement and dissipation. He bids him abandon all serious thoughts of God and eternity and religion. He welcomes him to the joys of an irreligious and profligate life, and gives him all the liberty which any sensualist could desire. Having so far represented the wicked seducer and destroyer of the young, he suddenly lays aside his assumed character, and with all the solemnity of a preacher from the world of spirits, closes the verse in a style of the most impressive admonition. The same young person whom he had just before pointed into the path of forbidden pleasure, he now points to the judgment seat of Christ, and alludes with awful emphasis to that tremendous reckoning which must succeed such a life as he had recommended. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Our subject at once lays itself before you. In the first part of the text, there is the ironical invitation to partake of sinful pleasure. In the latter part, there is a solemn admonition to remember the judgment. Let us endeavor so far as we can to enter into the spirit of both parts of the passage. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. Almost the very language by which many youth at the present day are tempted into the path of forbidden pleasure. Coming from the lips of the sensualist, it is no irony, it is the honest language of his heart, and he rejoices when it is listened to and obeyed. Hear the sentiment contained in these words a little expanded. You are now in the morning of life, the season most free from worldly care, and most adapted to worldly pleasure. However it may be with middle life or old age, when the vigor of the body is spent or the animal spirits have grown cool, this is not the time for religion. You are made to enjoy life, but religion is only a course of mortification and penance. It is a bondage both of soul and body, the grave of all that is bright and goodly in the lot of man. Resist then the claims of religion, at least for the present. If you should think it meet to beckon her in your last hour as a companion through the dark valley, be it so. But while these years of youthful buoyancy are passing off, make no league with this damper of human joy. Come with us into the scenes of mirth and revelry, in which reflection is drowned and restraint is not known. And here let your heart be surfeited with pleasure. What if, after having devoted hours to amusement, the thought should occur to you, while in the solitude of your chamber, that all that you had enjoyed was vanity? Endeavor to convince yourself of the contrary by thinking how happy you were while you were listening to the festive song, or while you were dancing to the sound of the viol. What if the open grave of some beloved friend should bring into your mind the gloomy thought of dying? Banish it as an intruder upon the joys of life, and think how useless it is to trouble yourself about what is inevitable. What if the thought should occur to you while at the gaming table or in the scenes of profane and boisterous riot that you have beloved friends who would weep blood if they should know where you are and how you are engaged? But what right have friends to abridge your pleasure? So long as you are willing that they should judge what is best for themselves, and you attempt no interference with their plans for enjoyment. In a word, let it be your grand object to drink as deeply at the fountain of worldly pleasure as you can. And as the hours of this golden season whirl off, let there be no inquiry agitated in your breath, more gloomy than how you shall crowd into each hour the largest amount of careless gaiety or sensual indulgence. But, my young friends, I dare not proceed farther in this strain of irony, which is suggested by my text, lest some of you should forget that it is irony, and should begin to think that you have found an advocate for your youthful vanities. I pass, therefore, immediately to the other part of the subject, in which I am to enforce the awful warning contained in the closing part of the text. But know thou that for all these things, God will bring thee into judgment. What an awful contrast is here presented to the language of the libertine to which we have just been attending. Reflect on the certainty of your being brought into judgment. Know thou, says the wise man, that is, be assured that the fact of which I speak shall take place without the possibility of failure. God has not left himself without witness on this subject, either in the constitution of our nature or in the dispensations of his providence. The doctrine of a future judgment is written more or less legibly on the conscience of every man. Else, how will you account for that painful restlessness which attends the remembrance of crimes long since committed, and the record of which is kept only in the perpetrator's own bosom? Moreover, the unequal distribution of rewards and punishments in the present life, in connection with the immutable justice of God, seems to constitute a ground of necessity for a future retribution. For in what other way shall the divine character be vindicated from the charge of partiality? But if reason has not spoken with sufficient distinctness on this subject, you cannot say that of the lively oracles, for here the doctrine stands written with God's own finger in letters of light. The text is decisive on this subject. For all these things God will bring thee into judgment. And again, God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And again, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that everyone may receive the things done in his body, according to that he hath done, whether it be good or bad. The evidence that you are to be brought into judgment, then, is complete. Whether you take counsel of reason or hold communion with conscience, or upon the volume of God's truth, this evident glares upon you. Forget it you may, trifle with it you may, but the awful fact you cannot change. I charge you then to remember, wherever you go or whatever you do, that there is a tremendous reckoning before you. Go, if you dare, into the haunts of irreligious mirth. Hear God's name profaned, and join in heaping scandal upon the cross. Go and hear the scoffer ask, where is the promise of his coming? And let your heart overflow with sensual joy. But remember that other scenes await you. Remember that it has gone out of the mouth of him who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, that you are yet to be brought into judgment. Contemplate the purpose for which you are to be brought into judgment. For all these things, says the wise man, that is, the things specified in the preceding part of the verse, given yourself up to a life of vanity and pleasure, you will be brought into judgment for the waste of your time. For every hour and moment which shall have been devoted to other purposes than those for which your time was given you, you will be brought into judgment for all your profane and idle discourse, which was fitted at once to affront your Maker, and to pollute your own mind and close it against serious reflection. You will be brought into judgment for every scene of vain amusement, for every meeting for sensual excess, for every effort to stifle conscience and forget God. You will be brought into judgment for all that you have done in corrupting others, for the deadly poison which is distilled from your lips, from your example, operating like the blast of death, wherever it has been communicated, for that fearful amount of sin and wretchedness which will have resulted from the accumulating influence of your life on many successive generations. In a word, for all that belongs to a life of pleasure, whether it respect action or enjoyment, its more immediate or more remote influences, you will be brought into judgment. How differently will a life of sinful pleasure appear to you when you come to view it in the light of the judgment from what it does now while your heart cheers you in the days of your youth? What you here plead for as innocent will then be seen to have involved crimson guilt. What you here regard as fraught with no danger will there be felt to have contained the elements of a heavy curse. What you here treat with levity as though it were a dream or a fable. Well, there gather all the importance that belongs to an appalling reality. How will your heart sicken and your spirit die within you when the light of eternity reveals your mistake in respect to the object of the present life? With what emotions will you realize that the period which you have spent in trifling was the only period given you to escape hell and to obtain heaven? Consider farther by whom you are to be brought into judgment. The text asserts that God will bring thee into judgment, God from whom came all the blessings which you have perverted to purposes of sinful pleasure, and against whom every sin that you have committed has been an act of rebellion, God whose heart-searching eye has always been intent upon you, noticing the birth and progress and accomplishment of every sinful purpose, who has been with you when you supposed yourself alone, and who has kept an exact record of all that you have thought and spoken and done from the first moment of your existence. God, who, though long-suffering and gracious, is yet just and holy, and will by no means clear the guilty, who has all the means of punishment in the universe at his command, and can execute with infinite ease the penalty which his righteous authority ordains. And is this a great and awful being who is to bring you into judgment? Say whether it will not be a fearful thing to fall into the hands of such a judge. Were your final retribution to be decided by a mere man or a mere creature, you might suppose it possible that you should escape the woes which hang over your eternal destiny. You might hope something from his limited knowledge. Possibly he might not be acquainted with all your transgressions and all their aggravating circumstances, or he might form too low an estimate of your punishment, which you deserve on account of them. Or you might hope something from his limited power. You might imagine that by some combination of energy or influence which could be formed, you might either resist the mandate which had summoned you to judgment, or prevent the execution of the final sentence. Or you might presume upon the triumph of mercy over justice. You might hope that some appeal could be made to the heart of the judge, which would lead him at least to abate the severity of your doom, even though such mitigation should tarnish his character and weaken his government. But surely you can form no such imaginations in respect to the infinite God. You cannot hope to evade the scrutiny of his eye, and to resist the might of his arm, and to awaken a blind and indiscriminate compassion in his heart. But though you may be courageous on every other occasion, yet can your heart endure, or your hands be strong when you shall stand before the throne of Almighty Power, beneath a searching look of omniscience, to receive a just recompense for a life wasted in sinful pleasure? Meditate on the time of your being brought into judgment. It would seem that the day of judgment, appropriately so called, a day which is to make a full revelation of the secrets of every heart, and to pour the light of a complete vindication over the character of God, is yet comparatively distant. There are purposes to be accomplished in the scheme of providence, preparatory to that august occasion, which may require the lapse of ages. Nevertheless, there is an important sense in which it may be said that the judgment is near. The world into which the soul passes at death is a world of retribution. Whatever means God intends ever to employ to bring the sinner to repentance have been employed previous to that period. The first gleam of light from the eternal world reveals to the soul its destiny, which, though not yet published to the universe, is fixed by a decree which the whole creation could not change. And whatever the soul experiences, whether of joy or of woe, subsequently to that period belongs to its everlasting retribution. Dream not, then, my young friend, that the period of your being brought into judgment is remote. Will you presume upon youth as a security against it? So did that young man who the other day was hurried into eternity in the fullness of youthful vigor and the bloom of youthful hope. Will you presume upon health as a security against it? Go then and read a lesson from yonder tombstone, and there you will find that protracted sickness and a lingering death scene are not the necessary accompaniments of disillusion. You will find that death may overtake you, while your hands are strung with vigor, that your passage through the dark valley may be the passage of a moment? Or do you presume on promising worldly prospects? I could point you to many a father who would tell you, weeping, that he once had a son whose prospects were in every respect as bright as yours. But the death had marked him as his victim, and he had sunk into an early grave. Where then, I ask, is your security against being brought into judgment? When you go into a scene of amusement, how do you know but that the summons may meet you there? When you mingle in the midnight revel, can you be certain that you are not passing the last hour of your probation? When you lay your head upon your pillow without lifting your heart to God, who has given you the assurance that that is not the night which your soul is to be required of you, that a voice from eternity may not break upon your ear amidst the stillness of midnight, calling you to judgment. But be it so that you would fill up 70 years, it would still remain true that you are on the threshold of the judgment. That period, long as it may now seem to you, is but as a hand's breadth. While you are dreaming of its continuance, it will be spent, and your spirit will be rushing forth to meet its God. And it is so that the judgment is not only a reality, but that its amazing scenes are so soon to burst upon you? Tell me then, O immortal soul, what account you are prepared to render of that wasted, perverted life when you enter the invisible world and stand before the dread tribunal. Contemplate, moreover, the circumstances of your being brought into judgment. If you consider this expression as referring to the removal of the soul by death to a state of retribution, then the circumstances of this event must in great measure remain concealed till they are disclosed to you in experience. In respect to some of them, however, you may form at least a probable opinion. By the power of a burning fever, or the gradual inroads of consumption, or perhaps by some mysterious form of disease, you may expect ere long to be laid upon the bed of death. It may be that in that awful hour you may be given up to delirium or insensibility, and may close your eyes upon the objects of sense without knowing where you are, or through what scenes you are passing. Or it may be that your rational powers will be active and bright, so that you will be conscious of all that happens to you in your passing through the dark valley. You may see around you beloved friends who will alternately fasten upon you a look of mingled affection and agony, and turn away to smother the sobs which rise from a bursting heart. You may be sensible that the cold damps of death are already hanging upon your countenance, that the vital current is performing its last passage through your heart, that you are undergoing the convulsive struggle which is to dislodge the spirit from its clay tabernacle. And supposing that your life has been devoted to sinful pleasure, how probable it is that conscience will pour its accusations into your ears and tell you of an offended judge and a coming of wrath and of interminable woe. How probable that the ghosts of wasted hours and days and years will come up in frightful succession before you, as ministers of wrath, when you need so much to be attended by angels of consolation, amidst some such assemblage of gloomy circumstances as I now have supposed, you may expect that your spirit will take its flight for the eternal world. And while your body is dressing for the grave, that spirit will be mingling in scenes of new and awful interest. And though it will have done with the agony attendant on the dissolution of the body, it will be convulsed by an agony far more dreadful, the beginning of a never-dying death. Oh, what a moment will that be, when you shall first know by experience the misery of the lost. But if you consider the text as referring immediately to the great day of final decision, the circumstances which will attend your being brought into judgment will be of a far different character from those which we have just described. And while in the former case we learn them principally from observation, in the latter we derive our knowledge solely from the oracles of God. In the hour next previous to that in which the immediate preparation for the judgment shall commence, your body dissolved into its original elements will be slumbering with its kindred dust. and your spirit will be mingling with other lost spirits in the region of despair. Suddenly the skies will send forth a sound. It will be the blast of the trumpet of God, which will echo from one end of the earth to the other, bursting open the doors of every sepulcher, breaking up the slumbers of all their inhabitants, and recollecting from the earth, the ocean, the air, the scattered dust of every child of Adam that shall have died since the creation, the union between the body and spirit restored. The same body that was laid in the dust rises up to meet the same spirit which had animated it. The judge descends from heaven in the glory of his Father. And with all his holy angels and around his throne are assembled all nations and kindreds and tongues and people. The righteous are placed in open distinguished honor at his right hand. The wicked, as a public proof of his indignation against their character, are summoned to the left. In this latter class, you who have been devoted to sinful pleasure will be found. There you will be obliged to contemplate the picture of your life drawn only in black, without one bright stroke to relieve the eye from a uniform and sickening gloom. There you will be obliged with all others who have been lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God to hear the appalling sentence, "Depart, ye cursed, into everlasting fire, prepared for the devil and his angels." Oh, when that piercing sound shall enter into your ear, will it not rend your heart with agony and open your lips in wailing? For who can stand before his indignation, and who can abide the fierceness of his anger? Meditate finally on the consequences of your being brought into judgment, the consequence of your being summoned by death into a world of retribution. Will be an entire separation from all the objects of sense, from all the means of grace, from all the hopes of salvation. You will remember, indeed, how you once mingled in scenes of unhallowed mirth and revelry, but with the remembrance of these scenes will be associated the reflection that they have gone by forever, while the effect of them remains to be felt in an interminable scene of anguish. You will think of Sabbath given you to prepare for heaven, but perverted to purposes of mere amusement, of invitations and warnings a thousand times pressed upon you, but as often treated with indifference or contempt, of friends who had come with the tenderest concern to speak to you of the things that belong to your peace, but who returned to their closets mourning that they could gain no access to your heart. But you will be obliged also to reflect that there are no more Sabbaths for you, that the last invitation of mercy, the last warning to repent, has died away upon your ear, that no Christian friend can come where you are to unburden a full heart in prayers and tears and expostulations for the salvation of your soul. You may remember, too, how in all your mad pursuit of pleasure, you still clung to the hope of future repentance, but the delusion is broken up. Even the atoning blood of Jesus can now no longer reach you. And while you are in exile from all the good, real, or imaginary which you once enjoyed, you will be subject to the corrosion of a guilty conscience, will be a companion of fiends and reprobates, and as long as you look forward into eternity, will see one woe rising after another, like the billows of the ocean in a train that will never end. The consequence of your being brought before the last tribunal, and of receiving a formal and final sentence from the lips of the judge, will be still more tremendous. At the close of this awful transaction, you will behold with a bewildered look of agony, all above, beneath, around, vaulted with the funeral fires of this great world. And when amidst this final wreck of nature, you look out for a refuge from the fiery storm, no refuge in the universe will be open for you except that dungeon of woe in which the wrath of God is to have its perpetual operation. Into that prison of the universe, that grave of lost but living souls, you will immediately enter. And there in the hopelessness of unavailing anguish, there amidst the curses and wailings of the lost, there where the eye can fasten upon no object which the wrath of God has not fastened before it, you must run the dreary round of everlasting ages. The sentence was, Depart, ye cursed, into everlasting fire. And it is so that this prison is built for eternity, that these flames are kindled for eternity, that these bolts and bars and chains bespeak an eternal residence in these vaults of despair. Will not some messenger come hither from yonder blissful regions, though it be 10,000 millions of ages hence, to tell thee that this long night of suffering will yet be succeeded by a morning of peace and joy? No, sinner, there are no such tidings in store for thee. Thou wert sentenced there for a period as unlimited as the duration of God, and thy sentence is irreversible. I inquire now of the conscience of every youth present, who is devoted to sinful pleasure, whether these meditations upon the judgment do not throw an aspect of terror over the course which he is pursuing, and whether he dare persist any longer in a course which must so certainly lead to such a tremendous result. If this life of vanity and pleasure had no connection with eternity, or if it were itself to be eternal, however pitiful a portion you might find in it, we might consent with less reluctance to leave you to your wretched choice. But connected as it is with a course of illimitable and unutterable suffering, wonder not that we call upon you with pressing importunity to abandon it. Do you ask whether you must abandon all the amusements of the world? I answer, abandon all upon which you dare not ask the blessing of God. All of which crowd out of your thoughts the realities of eternity, all of which you are unwilling to think of in connection with the prospect of dying, all of for which you would dread that God should bring you into judgment. Do you ask again what those amusements are in which you may safely indulge while you are yet unreconciled to God? I reply by asking what amusement you would choose if you were just ready to be enveloped in the flames of a burning house, or if you were under sentence of death and had but one more hour before you should ascend the scaffold. Do you spurn at the suggestion of trifling in circumstances like these? Then say not that we are superstitious when we tell you that you have no time to waste in amusement, while yet your whole work for eternity is before you, and for aught you can tell, each passing hour may be your last. Do you plead for a single indulgence? Do you say, let me go into one more scene of vain recreation and cheer my heart once more in these days of my youth? And then I will abandon the vanities of the world forever. My young friend, the very resolution is a cheat. But even if it were not, who has told you that the one scene of recreation may not occupy the whole period given you to prepare for eternity, and that you are not subjected to the alternative of turning your back upon it, or of certainly losing heaven? Is it rational, rather, is it not the height of madness to waste a single moment while you are suspended between an eternal heaven and an eternal hell? I leave this solemn subject, beloved youth, with your consciences. I entreat you to make a serious and practical application of it. I pray the God of all grace to bring it seasonably to your remembrance and give it its legitimate influence over your feelings and conduct. But if all which has been said shall appear to you as an idle tale, if after having been warned of the solemnities of the judgment you are prepared to rush back to a course of sinful pleasure, then I must leave you with the same awful irony and the same solemn admonition with which I began this discourse. Rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart, and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. Lecture 5. Regard to the favor of the world contrasted with a regard to the favor of God. 1 Thessalonians 2, verse 4. Not as pleasing men, but God. The church to which this epistle was addressed is supposed to have been planted by Paul and Silas soon after the outrages committed upon them at Philippi and recorded in the 16th chapter of the Acts of the Apostles. In the verses immediately preceding the text, The apostle alludes to the signal success which attended his first labors among the Thessalonians, and notices as an occasion of rejoicing the fact that he and his companion in labor, notwithstanding the shameful treatment they had just met in a neighboring city, and the obstacles which they still had to encounter, were enabled in the strength of divine grace to preach the gospel with boldness and fidelity. And what chiefly encouraged them to these courageous efforts was the reflection that they had no mercenary purposes to answer, and that there was nothing in their management in respect to which they need shrink from the strictest scrutiny, but all was open and honest, not as pleasing men, or as consulting the tastes and prejudices of the world, but as endeavoring to secure the approbation of God which trieth our hearts. The text, you perceive, has a primary reference to the ministers of the gospel. And surely if there be a class of men in respect to whom it is preeminently important that they should act under the influence of the principle which the apostle here recognizes, ministers of the gospel constitute that class. But it is important that all others should be governed by this principle as well as ministers. It is especially important that its influence should be felt by persons in the morning of life, because that is the period in which habits are formed, which in most instances constitute the elements of future character. When the apostle in our text institutes an apparent opposition between pleasing men and pleasing God, we are not to suppose that he intends to forbid every effort to please men, for this would be inconsistent not only with many of his exhortations, but with his own conduct. Let every one of us, saith he, please his neighbor for his good to edification. And again, I am made all things to all men, that I might by all means save some. The gospel not only allows, but requires that we should seek the favorable regards of our fellow men, especially as a means of our own usefulness, and the course of conduct which it prescribes is exactly fitted to such a result. Hence it has been said, with much truth and force, that the gospel contains the most perfect system of politeness which the world has seen. The apostle in our text intends only to contrast a supreme regard to the approbation of the world and a supreme regard to the approbation of God as governing principles of action, and to imply that they are perfectly incompatible with each other. My purpose in this discourse is to illustrate and contrast the influence of these two dispositions. Number one, upon human character. Number two, upon human happiness. Number one, I remark in the first place that it is the tendency of a supreme regard to the approbation of the world to produce a fickle character, of a supreme regard to the approbation of God, a stable one. Who that has any knowledge of the world needs to be told that its maxims, principles, conduct are constantly changing? What at one period is admired as elegant or praiseworthy soon comes to be regarded with indifference, and perhaps ultimately sinks into contempt. And on the other hand, what at one time is considered mean or worthless gradually rises into respectability, and it may be at length becomes an object of admiration. For a complete illustration of this remark, you need only look into the walks of what is commonly called fashionable life, and you will see one fashion after another in respect to manners, dress, equipage, and many other things succeeding so rapidly that even the devotees of fashion themselves are scarcely able to do homage to every new idol. Have you a fair specimen of the fluctuation of human opinion? If then you make human opinion the standard of your conduct, and that standard is constantly varying, your conduct must of course exhibit a corresponding course of changes, and here is the foundation of a fickle character. On the other hand, the person who sees supremely the approbation of God has a fixed standard of action. The law of God is his rule of duty. And that law, like its author, is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He may indeed sometimes be embarrassed in respect to particular cases to know what this law requires and what it forbids, but in general it marks out for him a plain path. Hence he acts not only in conformity to a fixed standard, but generally without hesitation. and in this way he cannot fail to acquire and to exhibit stability of character. Number two, it is the tendency of a supreme regard to the approbation of the world to produce a timid character, of a supreme regard to the approbation of God a courageous one. The devotee of the world's favor has no easy task to perform. He well knows that he must shape his conduct to suit different and opposite dispositions, that in securing the approbation of one, he is liable to lose that of another, that the means which may seem to him best adapted to gain favor may prove to be fraught with injury or disgrace. Besides, he has sometimes at least a secret conviction that the course which he is pursuing is wrong, that his maker and judge is offended that the supreme homage of his heart should be withheld from him. Here, then, is a double influence exerted to produce a timid character. On the one hand, he fears that he shall not gain the object which he is seeking. On the other, he fears that if he does gain it, it will be at the expense of what is infinitely more valuable. Is it not obvious that a character formed under such an influence will be likely to bear a strong impression of timidity? But in seeking supremely the favor of God, there is everything to inspire true courage. There is a certainty of success which is always favorable to bold and vigorous action. There is a reflection that he whose approbation we seek is all gracious and almighty, and that let the world do by us as it may, his favor is a sufficient portion. There is, moreover, the consideration that the course which we are pursuing is in itself the right course, the course which reason, conscience, the Bible all prescribe. Who that acts under the influence of considerations like these can fail to act with unyielding resolution? Number three, it is a tendency of a supreme regard to the approbation of the world to produce a hypocritical character, of a supreme regard to the approbation of God, an honest one. I have already remarked that owing to the different tastes and dispositions of men, it will often happen that course of conduct which will gain the approbation of one will forfeit that of another, and hence he whose governing object is to please the world will endeavor to appear to each one in such a character as he supposes will be most likely to secure regard, and to conceal from each one whatever he thinks will serve to excite displeasure. If he happens to fall in with one who is a warm advocate of any particular measure, the desire of popularity will naturally lead him to appear as an advocate of it also. Or if he happens to be in the company of another by whom the same measure is opposed, the same desire will operate to induce him, if not to join in opposition to the measure, at least to say nothing in its favor. In this way he contracts the habit of dissimulation, and his whole intercourse becomes a system of studied concealment. But on the other hand, he who is governed by a supreme regard to the favor of God has no motive to depart from the path of open and honest dealing. If he were to do this, he would instantly defeat his object, for not the approbation but the frown of Jehovah attends all insincerity. Moreover, the course which he is pursuing neither involves guilt nor awakens shame. There is therefore no reason why he should attempt to conceal his conduct from his fellow men, or why he should desire to conceal it from his Maker. Hence his character bears upon it the impression of truth and honesty. Number four, it is a tendency of a supreme regard to the approbation of the world to produce an inconsistent character, of a supreme regard to the approbation of God a consistent one. As he who is governed by a supreme regard to the favor of the world has no fixed rule of action, but is blown hither and thither by the breath of popular opinion, the different parts of his conduct must, of course, be inconsistent with each other. As the opinions of different individuals whom he wishes to please are at variance, there must be a corresponding variance between the course of conduct which he adopts in different cases in order to gain his object, and hence his life is a perpetual scene of contradictions. And if he happens to be a professor of religion, he is chargeable with double inconsistency, for not only are the different parts of his conduct inconsistent with each other, but his deportment as a whole is utterly inconsistent with his profession. For in his profession is implied an engagement to make the will of God and not the opinions of men the rule of his conduct.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, "which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart," from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, "God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, 'I have not commanded them,' whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the Papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the Papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew."